Late nights
with Travis and Lowe's.
With Travis and Lowe's.
Late nights with Travis and Lowe's.
Welcome to another Late Nights with Trav and Los. To my right today is Trav.
Hey, Los. How are you doing today?
I'm good.
Good, man. I'm excited because we're also sitting at the table. Well, actually, let's just talk about where we are. We're not in our normal... We're not in the cantina.
No.
We're in the middle of San Francisco right now, right in the heart. And we're sitting here at the table of John Lax. And you may have heard of him. Whenever I go, John Lax, everybody go, is that John? I go, yeah, Tijana Lax. They go, oh, yeah. So what I want to do is open up with like a quick profile. I want to talk about like these are the top level who John is and how everybody knows about John. And then we'll get into the nitty gritties.
Sure. So I'm primarily known for being a co-founder of Tijana Lax, as you noted, which was mm-hmm. started in 2002. And for a large body at that time, we were... a pretty highly regarded or well-known design firm based out of Toronto, Canada. We were known for working on a lot of stuff. The main things that I think people know about us are obviously working on the first version of Medium, which we got a lot of reputation for. Also our labs work that we did, which included the Hyperlapse,
I love the labs work.
The Google Street View Hyperlapse. Yeah. We did some other stuff inside of there. Yeah. Oh. That was pretty popular.
I didn't even know about that.
You didn't know
awesome
that?
Stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't know that you guys did it.
Yeah. We did the original Hyperlapse.
Wow, cool.
Product. Where you use Google Street View and you create mm-hmm. those little movies. The labs group were great. They did a bunch of really, really cool experiments. I think then our writing was really known. Our website, we became very well known for being a source for designers. And, of course, the Photoshop files, the iOS Photoshop files. So mm-hmm. those are some things that in the history of the company, which I worked at for 12 years. I mean, from the time I was 30 years old till, 42. So, like, for a large... chunk of my career, and that's probably what I'm most known for.
Yeah, a lot of it is a pattern of giving back to the community.
Yeah,
in terms of like those downloadable Photoshop files where you guys reconstructed iOS from the ground up, and allowed designers to like have those shortcuts for their clients, and your writing, your case studies, mm-hmm. and other things. There's this pattern of just trying to give to the community. Also. You've been speaking a lot about pricing and business approaches that Tijana Lax kind of like developed mm-hmm. over the years. And we have a lot of content that we talked about before we even started recording this that maybe we'll like put in a special episode or something.
You mean the hour and a half we recorded before this? Yes.
John has a lot of...
I have a lot to say.
He does. And that it's just really, really... Actually, as somebody who's trying to host this show, it's interesting because I'm so interested in everything that you have to say, but it's also so much like the volume of like experience.
Here's a funny story I can tell you about all this.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So first of all, I am like a very, and this is partly just my age, like we're like growing up, but like I'm a huge sort of like progressive rock jam band fan, right?
Yeah.
So like I will listen to like 30-minute songs and like be really into that. And when we were writing those, the one joke we always had at Tijana Lax was like we would write these long stories.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was always had this anxiety, like this is the most self-indulgent thing. This is like a guitar solo, right? Like this is, and we also, and so we were very self-aware that like, we had this tendency, and like I have this tendency, uh-huh. and so like I projected out, I think, a little bit into the company that I created or helped create.
Yeah.
And the other thing that we'd always joke about was like we were writing those stories we wrote are like so inside baseball, right? Like only other designers give a shit about this stuff.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
we talked before, it's like the director's cut, right? Like you got to be like a super nerd to be into it. And I always worried, like, do you guys know who like Yngwie Malmsteen is? The guitarist?
No.
Exactly. Okay. Or Joe Satriani.
Yeah, I know
like,
that name.
Yeah, yeah. So there's like these guitarists that are like super technical that only other guitarists like. Like it's pretty much unlistenable.
Are you a guitarist, John?
I am, but really bad one, but like not like that. But like
sure.
But like we always joke like we didn't want to become the Yngwie Malmsteen of design. We're like nerded out designers would be like, no, these guys are the best, and like no one else got it. So we always were very worried about that and everything we put out, that like these were our guitar solos and we were being way too like
that's
like
funny.
Inside where people who got it, but then like no one else did. Because if you're running a business, you kind of want other people to get it who are going to pay you, right?
Yeah. But as I understand it, like the reports that you did on the television, like the
PVR,
PVRs, and like the you know the medium thing that you mentioned, those actually did do a lot of positive for your business.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I have a question, actually. You mentioned music just now, and I noticed right away when I came in, you have those posters in the hall there. And then when I was using the bathroom, you have like the horns, the fist making the, what do you call that?
Devil horns.
The devil horns, right. That's what I was calling it when I was a kid. Like, rock on. I don't know, we call them the sticks, the horns. Does music play a big role in the way you look at things?
I'm a huge, like, I'm a very big music fan, obviously. Like, I surround myself with imagery of it. I think everyone will say like music's played a big part role in their life, but like it is something that very much inspires me. And I originally wanted to be a music journalist.
Oh, interesting.
That was I graduated from journalism school originally, in the mid-90s, and I thought I wanted to be a music journalist. Really inspired by people like Cameron Crowe, who did Almost Famous, who became a writer, but earlier when he was a teenager, he was a Rolling Stone music writer.
Oh, interesting. When was he a teenager?
Yeah, he was a teenager. He then went on to write Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which was originally like him going back to high school because he never had a high school experience. Okay. I mean, we talk about Cameron Crowe, but I was really inspired by that. If you go upstairs into where my books, I actually have paper. It's bound together in books. You'll see you'll see like, you know, Lester Bangs, who's a very famous writer. That's Hunter S. Thompson right there.
Yeah.
The famous gonzo journalist. I'm pointing to a picture on my wall.
If you're listening, just look to your right.
Yeah. And it's a Ralph Steadman original, actually signed. Cool. I've had that for a while.
It's interesting to, I'm totally convinced that we're going to release that first, you know, hour that we talked.
Like uncut?
Yeah. I think
you're going to do like a basement tapes like after
why
this?
Why not? Like, why not have the director's
That is
edition?
My guitar solo. That hour and a half I rambled for self-indulgently.
Yeah. But the reason I'm referencing it right now is because you talked a lot about being able to ask the right question of the client, being able to understand the real situation.
Yeah.
The kind of like the interview, right? And I'm noticing now I'm kind of connecting the dots where a journalist would be given those skills to be able to quickly assess the situation, ask the right questions to get the information that they need. And also writing is a big part of your career and your history. So it's so cool to like, I don't know. I love connecting dots and things like that. So,
yeah, I think like once you get to know me a bit better, I think you can contextualize a lot of the choices and things that I did in my career. Like, oh yeah, I get that. Like, as we said before, if you don't release this to give some context for it, it's like we were really interested when we did the site that people kind of we became very known for, the Tina Lack site. Yeah. I was like, not just me, but I was definitely a strong voice in the room saying like, I really want to explore the notions of long form storytelling, like deep word, not just like the words, but the visuals and like the side pieces. We were like super interested in how, you know, designed pieces could tell a story, how words would tell a story, that you would take some time to read it and pore over it. And I mean, those things were like, you know, I think the story of Tien and Lax was something like 6,000 words or something like that. I mean, that is a lot. That is a significant piece to read.
Yeah.
What was really interesting from a new business standpoint is it acted as this qualifier for clients, where a client would call you and sometimes they'd be like, I read every word on your site. And then they'd start to like tell you the things and you could tell like they actually had.
Yeah.
And they're like, I get totally what you're doing and I need to work with you.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
That's
really it was like this, it was this test.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
That's really good.
That's good.
So going back to the timeline.
Yeah.
We're at Teen Hannah Lacks and you guys worked at, I mean, you guys did amazing work, obviously. And you were there for 12 years. You worked there for 12 years. And then at the end of 2014, you guys signed with Facebook.
Yeah.
In 2015, January, you guys announced that.
Yeah.
And moved on. So it was about you and Jeff and about 10 other people that worked there all went to Facebook. And you shut the doors at Tiana Lacks. There was a little bit of a PR kind of like a
didn't media. Go well.
Didn't go well. And we're going to talk about maybe that in the next episode. Okay. But what I want to talk about is like going back to your tendencies to be like a storyteller and to be, interested in like the right question and stuff. Like where does that come from? Like, I want to go way back. I want to do the unstory. So the thing, okay, guys, let's pause the podcast for a second. Not really, we're running. Oh, I'm fake pausing, and the people who are listening are like, that was a fake pause.
Yeah.
So the thing about John is,
you're like, let's pause. And I like sighed, like, oh, thank God.
Go on. Now we got you.
John is that like he has been on like 50 podcasts. Like I went to my podcast app, I searched his name, and I was like, oh, okay, we have a lot. We have a lot of content on this guy. He's certainly told, like if I said, John, here's a microphone, he could, you know, take a few hours on his own. And that's good. But I want to get to, and I was telling Los this on the way over here, I want to get to the, and he said, the unstory,
yeah.
Right? And so this interest that you have in asking the right questions, in telling the story, in uncovering what the needs are,
yeah.
That's kind of what I want to get to. And like, where does that even come from? Was that a part of growing up? Was it...
So I'll tell you a little bit about my family. I was born in Toronto, uh-huh. Canada, and my parents were both lawyers. And so the notion of debate and digging into something, deeply understanding something, attacking it from multiple angles was definitely part of my upbringing. So like around the dinner table, you know, and a lot of, you know, my parents' friends and peer groups were also often like lawyers and professionals. I'm Jewish, and there's a, you know, sort of a tradition of heated debate, if you know right. any, you know, Jewish families. And so I definitely grew up around an environment of intense scrutiny of everything. You know, like I would get cross-examined.
You, yeah. Where were you?
Yeah. I mean, not.
Were you
mean,
at yes, Johnny's house?
Yes, definitely. Like on things like that, but just in general, like ideas were cross-examined,
right?
And were rigorously examined. You know, in every aspect.
So little John is like at the table. The adults are going at it. They're doing their thing.
Yeah.
Was it just all osmosis, or were you ever like taught how to dig?
No, I wasn't taught. Like it was not like here's how to do this. I think it was definitely like osmosis or being around that kind of environment.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
you know, if you're at a dinner table where people are talking, you know, very heatedly and ideas are being thrown around, and like I remember quite vividly, you know, sitting like, you know, 10, 11 years old, and after, you know, dinner, the people are discussing politics and they're discussing, you know, books and ideas, mm-hmm. and you're sitting there and you're just trying to figure out like, how can you participate in this conversation?
Right.
And so that was definitely part of my upbringing. And I'm very comfortable in debate.
Mm. Okay.
I'm very comfortable in like rhetorically taking the other side, even if it's not what I believe in.
Mm-hmm.
Which can be very frustrating for some people around me, where like I will start to argue the other side, and they're like halfway through, like, you don't even believe this. Like, what are you doing? So that's definitely been part of my upbringing for sure. And then the storytelling thing, I think, I don't know where that. I read a ton as a kid.
Yeah.
One thing I had.
What kind of literature?
I read anything. I mean, like everything. I had this thing that I don't think could ever really be replicated because this doesn't really exist. But there was this amazing bookstore, neighborhood bookstore, called Writers and Company. And there was this woman who owned it who was one of these people who she would tell me. She'd say, "Tell me the last two books you read that you loved." And you tell her, and then she would like go and start pulling.
Oh, cool.
Like, you got to read this. You got to read this. You got to read this. it doesn't exist anymore.
That does
right?
not exist.
Travis and I looked at each other and just nodded our heads.
Yeah,
because we long for things like that.
I remember reading the first Jurassic Park.
Yeah,
and then like I was like, now I'm a reader,
right?
Because it was so it like blew my, you know, 13-year-old skull.
Like this is to be transported.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, I need more of this. And so I went to the library and I was severely disappointed by the next thing you read, right? Like,
I had this woman, I'll tie the story together in a second. But anyway, my mom, because she was a big reader. Like all my whole family were big readers.
Mm, yeah.
And she saw that I was reading and she said, look, there's an account at Writers and Company.
Yeah.
you can buy as many books as you want. You can just go in there. And so when I was like 13, 14, it was like I couldn't buy anything, but I could go to the store and literally buy as much as I wanted.
That's amazing.
And I would walk out with stacks of books. And I would read. I mean, it was like fiction. It was poetry. I wasn't big on poetry, but I would read it sometimes. Yeah. I would read like mainly fiction, mainly New American fiction was what I was most interested in. It was really.
Did you have an absolute favorite book?
I mean, the book that I think my Jurassic Park was, yeah. was Catcher in the Rye, which I read when I was probably like 12 or 13. And I just like, that's where I was like, had that same like aha moment.
Yeah.
Where I was like, wow.
You're all phonies.
Yeah. just like I understood like what it meant to be transported in a yeah. book and like connect with characters wow. and things like that. And then I got very, very heavily in to Raymond Carver, who's an American, mainly short story writer. They made a film of his movies called Shortcuts, which is sort of a collection of his short stories strung together into a film which you can go check out. But read his stuff is it's phenomenal. I got very deep into him. I got into a whole bunch of new American writers in the 80s and 90s. And yeah, like reading just became like a huge thing. And so I think narrative storytelling just comes fundamentally from reading a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
And sorry, because I was into journalism, I love the stories that journalists told. I loved reading magazine pieces, like yeah. longer form writing. As I got into my late teens, I was like a voracious magazine reader and loved that form of writing.
Any publication in particular?
I mean, at that time, I think like when I was in high school, the publications that were doing, I think, really good reporting at the time were like Esquire at that time was doing like really good long form editorial. Mm. GQ occasionally would have good stuff. I was the New Yorker I just didn't get because it was just too kind of like erudite for me at that time. But I really, Rolling Stone
yeah.
at that time was doing really, really good reporting. Men's, Outside magazine, which at that time was publishing incredible writing about the outdoors. I mean, John Krakauer, Into Thin Air. I mean, that comes later, but like that was they were writing, 5,000 word pieces on like adventures people were having on the world. National Geographic too was like doing really, really amazing stuff that I would love to read cover to cover. And then I was into music, so I was reading as I got into my late teens, early like into university. I would pick up a lot of the British music magazines like Q and Mojo, which were doing really interesting music writing. That's like a whole list of things that probably don't, most of those don't exist as publications anymore.
I think that's an interesting, it paints an interesting picture. So I'm imagining like young John reading a magazine, be like, this is what I want to be doing. Because you went to school for journalism.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. And sorry, because we are in the, like, I mean, when I was 14, 15, Thrasher magazine was a huge, huge influence on me.
Yeah.
In terms of the photography and the like that skate scene of the early 80s was just hugely influential to me. Sorry.
Dude, I share that. I was really big into the Thrasher and Ride and Surfer.
Yeah.
I had a subscription for Surfer for years and years, and I didn't even surf. It was just the adventurism and the voyeurism and the incredible design.
Was like David Carson working on it then? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then like Drapelin.
Beach culture. And, the Carsonism, the whole that thing was like so big for us in the early 90s.
Yeah.
So I get that for you. You mentioned earlier your parents are both lawyers and like how that kind of like the ability to pick apart a situation comes from that. Was there one parent that you were drawn to more or that you tried to please more?
I don't think so. No. And the one thing that my parents and I had conflict on was that they had an extremely like high bar for me. I was always falling short of it. And especially like my mother, like really had a hard time doing it. And I very early on decided that I just wasn't going to bother trying to like please them and just started to pursue the things that interested me.
What age is early on? What does that
mean? Probably like, I mean, I would say by the time I was like 16.
Okay.
I just knew that there were things that interested me that I knew were important that they just didn't understand.
Right.
And I wasn't going to work very hard to try to make them understand. So a good example of that, I'll go to university, just I'll jump forward a little bit, was when I got into journalism school, my mom was pretty psyched for me. I think she, by that point, thought that this could be a career for me. She knew I was okay writer. She knew I liked like that form, and she's like, go tell your dad. And I went down, I remember going downstairs to tell my dad, and I was like, Dad, I got in journalism school. And he turned around and he's like, can you make a living doing that? You know, yeah. It was just like,
deflated.
It was like, well, I'm doing it anyway. Like, I remember being like,
so you didn't really need their approval.
No. And it caused a lot of conflict later on in our lives. Like as I got much older, like into my third, like here's another thing, another story too. So first of all, just for some context, you can go read this on Medium because it's published, but my mom passed away, in 2013. And when I gave her eulogy, I talked a little bit about this, which was, my mom was an incredible woman. She became a lawyer. She went to law school when I was 2 years old.
Okay.
And so she would drop me at daycare at the university. There was a daycare at the university, and then go and do classes. I mean, this is in 1974.
Uh-huh.
First of all, women in the... There was just one of maybe only three women in the law school.
Yeah.
She's got a child.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's going back to school. She was a phys ed teacher prior to that.
Yeah.
And she graduates from law school. She becomes a lawyer in Toronto. She becomes a partner. My sister's born inside of that timeline. She eventually leaves law, becomes the assistant dean of the University of Toronto Law School, which is like the Harvard Law School of Canada.
Right.
She then eventually gets called to the bench to become a Ontario Supreme Court or Provincial Supreme Court, which would be equivalent to like a federal district court, I guess, or maybe like a state court. But we don't do elections for judges. It's an appointment by the government, and then it's like you just get to be a judge, you know, forever. And she sat on the bench until she passed away. And so she broke an incredible amount of barrier. Like she just had a career that most women of her era just never had.
Right.
So she was incredibly accomplished. My father on the other side is an incredibly accomplished litigator. Very well known in his field. And I made choices to go into non-traditional things. So when I graduated journalism school, when I was going to do an internship, I wanted to go work at this little startup magazine called Shift Magazine, running their website. This is 1994. You go to your mom, who is like this highly accomplished person, and you say, I'm going to go build a website. She's like, I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that's for. I've never seen it before.
Now she's my dad. Can you make a living doing this? Right. And I remember saying, there's this thing called the internet. I think it's going to make like this is going to be a thing. This is going to be something really important. Yeah. And she looked at me and she said, maybe you can get a job at the CBC. CBC is our like the BBC. It's like but in her mind, that was like what a career in journalism looked like, right? Which was a reasonable expectation in 1994. That's what your child would go and have. Like, she would listen to me on the radio or like something like that, right?
Yeah.
And I had this very different notion of what I wanted to do. And years later, I mean, many years later, she acknowledged that she was completely wrong. I mean, now the internet was like a thing. But she, like, trying to explain to your parent, like they had their best intentions.
Sure.
You know, but it was not inside the framework. But I was just like, nah, I'm doing that. Like, I just had a good sense that this is it. And I would say that one thing I don't know where it comes from. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a skill. Maybe it's just from like reading so much and being such a voracious consumer of things, where if I have one superpower, I'm pretty good at making connections and seeing trends.
Yeah.
And I just kind of understood innately, like, I didn't necessarily have the words for it. I'm like, the internet is going to profoundly change everything. I could just see that very deeply. And I just was like, I got to go do this. And I continue to have, even with Tina Lacks, I was like, technology is going to commoditize. Design is going to become more important. It just was very clear to me that that was going to happen.
That's interesting.
Didn't you? I don't know if I'm mistaken. Didn't you all invest in companies that were design thinking?
Yeah,
and
that was in 2004.
And then 10 years later, something like that.
So that was the UX fund.
Yeah,
that was the UX fund. So we had this idea, which is like, well, like we're trying to build this company that like UX is now a concept by 2000. And I think it was 2004 we did it. And we're like, well, if we deeply believe in UX, we should put our money where our mouth is. And so we took money from our company. We took $50,000, which for a company of our size was like a
sizable
amount of money.
Yeah.
And we went out and we played the stock market and we invested in companies we thought had good user experience.
Mm-hmm.
And we waited a year and we saw. Now, I think looking back on that, there were some flaws in our investor logic because... but we outperformed the stock market by like considerable amounts. It was a good portfolio. And we think that if we had done some extrapolations, like if we had held for long, because we only did it for a year, right?
Yeah.
If we had held for longer and given ourselves the ability to like tune the portfolio, we would have had like very strong returns.
Right.
And there's been subsequent research on this that actually shows that companies that value design like outperform the like their equivalents in the stock market.
Right.
But we very early on kind of were like, had a similar idea.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I'm noticing a pattern of questioning the status quo.
Yeah.
And whether that's in choosing your career, whether that's talking about design thinking or value-based pricing, kind of going against the grain.
Always.
Right. And I noticed that in your the career of your mother as well.
Yeah.
Right? Like how many barriers did she go through to get where she was? Like that's really, I'm like looking at this and I'm thinking like, man, I can't wait till my kid disappoints me with their career choice.
Well, anyway, I would recommend if you go on Medium, read the story because that point that you just made will come out even stronger when you read the eulogy because I make that point hopefully somewhat poignantly.
Like what you just said, but better.
There's a story there that you'll read.
Sure, yeah. We're gonna link to that in the show notes.
Yeah.
For everyone. That's really incredible. So
can I tell you one more thing? Like
yeah.
Have you guys done any sort of aptitude testing or like a Myers-Briggs or Strength Finders or any of those types of tests?
Well, I've done Myers-Briggs, just like the 16 personalities. But you know, when we met in Tel Aviv, you mentioned this in a lot more depth, and I'd really like to hear what you have to say about it.
Yeah. So first of all, I had been very skeptical of these things, where I thought they were kind of like horoscopes. You know, you can like read anything into
that
it.
That sounds just like me.
Yeah.
I'm a Gemini and a Virgo and a Taurus and a Pisces.
Yeah.
You say Pisces?
Or whatever.
I like people.
It's a Pisces. Yeah.
And so I had been somewhat skeptical of these things. And I did one in 2011 called Oxicon. O-X-I-C-O-N, which you will not have heard of because it's kind of difficult to actually take this test.
Mm.
And Oxicon is a test given to new business people.
Mm.
And the reason I was taking it was we were trying to figure out a lot of this value pricing thing. We're trying to get better at new business. And I hired a guy named Blair Enns, E-N-N-S, who has a company called Win Without Pitching.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a new business consultant for services firms.
Mm-hmm.
And he's awesome. He's an amazing guy. And what he does is he runs companies he works through this test because it gauges your ability or you know your skills at how good will you be at new business.
Mm.
And I ran this test.
Unique test.
Yeah, it's this totally unique test, right? And I did it not really knowing what to expect.
Yeah.
Anyway, Oxicon rates you on four dimensions.
Mm.
Basically competitiveness.
Mm.
Power, authority, and autonomy are the four dimensions. So competitiveness is like, do you need to win? How badly do you need to win?
Yeah.
So obviously with some salespeople who really need to win, like they don't care how they do it. They just like want to win. They want to get the sale, right? So it's on a scale of 1 to 100.
Yeah.
I score a 5.
You don't want to win.
I don't give a shit about winning.
I love it.
I'm not competitive. I don't play video games. I played sports in high school and I enjoyed it, but I probably enjoyed it more for the like
camaraderie
and like
people.
And I got pretty good. I was a pretty good rugby player.
Yeah.
But like, if we won, lost, I didn't really care. Sure. I just sort of enjoyed the act of playing the game, right?
Yeah.
And probably being around, like, you know, a social group.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a 5 out of 5 like when I got the score back, I was like, huh, because I hadn't really realized about myself. The other thing is, so then there's a power score, which is really about, it really has to do with like your need to be liked.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so high power, like depending where you exist in your power score, yeah. you either like have a high need to be liked and have like affiliation and like, you know, do you need to connect with others? And so people with like really high affiliation / power scores, you know, they have a high need to be liked. And so in sales, that can sometimes be problematic where you just want to be friends with the person and like, oh yeah, you can have that for half price. Right.
Okay.
Like that's, you know, done, yeah, right. Yeah. Cause they just want you, the person just wants to be liked. Right.
Yeah.
I actually have a very low score in that too. I actually have a very low need to be liked,
yeah.
which I'll come back to in a second.
Don't care about winning. Don't care if you like me.
Yeah. But I do have, I have a pretty high,
don't care about anything.
I have a pretty high score in authority.
Yeah.
Which is a need to be respected.
Okay.
And, what that means is I want to be perceived as knowledgeable and expert.
Mm.
I mean, some of the stuff you guys are saying, right? Like, yeah. wow, you got so much to say. Like that's yeah. part of my personality.
Yeah. You're just lighting up when I say that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like,
I do.
I dig it. Like, that's cool. Like, I figured some stuff out, and I like to talk about yeah. it, right? I think I figured some stuff yeah. out. And then the final one is autonomy, which is going to hit in on your point. And this is my highest score.
Mm.
And autonomy is your ability to follow rules, procedures, things like that are laid out for you, right? So the lower your autonomy score, the more willing you are to, like,
follow.
Here's a set of rules. Just go do this. So in sales, what that means is like follow this script.
Okay.
Right. Or do this. If you have a low autonomy, you will just read that script.
Yep.
You know, off. You don't care. But you have a high autonomy score. You will react very negatively to that. So I have a high autonomy score, which leads me to always want to like look for like a new angle. It makes me want to figure out how to do this differently. It makes me want to like see the new things. Mm-hmm. If you map this then against like Myers-Briggs and StrengthFinders, there's a pretty clear picture that emerges in my personality type, which is I like ideas. I like connections of ideas. I like the things. I like to see new connections in things. And I will pursue that, obviously. And I won't compete on someone else's rules.
Mm-hmm.
Where that was very helpful in new business was someone would say, hey, we want you to sign up for an RFP. If you're competitive, you're like, show me the rules. I will win at this game.
Yeah.
My reaction is I don't respond to RFPs.
Mm-hmm. I don't
play by your rules.
Yeah. Right.
So now let's talk about how I can help you.
Would people get offended by that response?
Not offended. I think that there's a certain person who would come in who wouldn't be empowered to go outside of the rules. So like a purchasing department.
Yeah.
And I would say, we don't deal with purchasing departments. And this person would go, well, that's my job. I'm like, all right, well, good luck.
Right.
And they wouldn't get offended. I don't think they'd yeah. be. Sometimes they were a little offended. I think when large companies come to you and you tell them you don't want their business, that's not something they're used to hearing.
Yeah. yeah.
But I was far more comfortable, like, because I didn't need to win.
Right, right.
I was okay with them walking away.
Yeah.
But I, like, what I wanted them to do was I would reframe the rules to something I wanted to do, which is, like, let's have a conversation about ideas, about what you need.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be, like, personally, I'm going to be better at that. And I think you, and I believe you are better served by that.
Right.
So that's where it comes from. So anyway, this is all part of just who I am as a person.
Yeah. And this gets into, like, the last thing I want to talk about for this episode about, like, your personal design philosophy.
Yeah.
Like, how do these things, like the your Oxycon there, your Myers-Briggs, the history that we talked about, how does that roll itself into design?
Yeah. I do get a real charge out of creating things that people find valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So while I don't specifically want to win, meaning in a competitive set, like I need to have my thing be used by absolutely more people than someone else's thing.
Mm-hmm.
I do enjoy conceiving of something and then seeing other people like get use and value and charge of it. So whether that's if I'm sharing an idea and you're like, wow, I never thought about that. Okay, that's cool. Or
yeah.
I create this thing and you're like, oh, this is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get a lot of joy
right
out of that. And whether it's sharing an idea and whether that idea manifests itself in writing or that idea manifests itself in design or in a product or in a feature, like those are all the same to
right
me. Like those all work together for me.
The follow on question that I have is like, how does your new position at Facebook satisfy that drive?
I get to make things for a lot of
I know
people.
Yeah. So, okay, so
the things I help make, not that I make, but like the things that I help influence to come into the world, you know, have a stage that is just immense. It's like 1.6 billion people.
Right. And so you're, this is gotta be pretty gratifying, right? Like, so your drivers are not competitiveness or like to be liked or anything, but to give things to people to in your own like autonomous way. And now you have like one of the biggest stages in the world.
Yeah. And I think that where I really get to do this at Facebook is we are, you know, daily trying to figure out the things we should build for the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That genuinely we want things that are like good into the world, right? Mm-hmm. And we believe that if we do that, we, I'm putting air quotes around win, meaning like we are more valuable. People continue to get value from Facebook. They use it. They connect with friends and family. And, mm-hmm. and at the end of the day, the world is a bit better. This is the place to go do it. And if you look at my career, since the first crappy website I made in 1994 for a band, by yeah. the way,
I think that's the story of every almost, single design. Yeah. It was always for a band.
I was trying to tie it back to like the music game yeah. that we started with.
Well done.
How to get an industry design for a band.
Yeah. Cause they need design.
Yeah, right? They do.
And you know, like if you just kind of draw a line, I've just been trying to make things that people use for the whole of my career.
So, T. Hannah Lacks, how many people were you at the?
We got as big as about just over 50 people at our largest. At our largest,
right? And so
we were about 40 when we shut down. We actually pulled back a little.
Mm-hmm. Just a bit about me. I come from a startup. We were at 40 when I left, and then I went to Google. And one of the things that I noticed was, not just the products that I'm making are hitting that kind of scale of people, but also internally in the organization itself,
yeah.
you have a lot bigger audience for your own crazy or stupid ideas, or even like just like camaraderie or making connections, right? So like the organization itself, I'm not talking about its audience, the organization offers this platform as well. Have you noticed that at Facebook as well?
Yeah, and I think yes, I have, and I think that if what excites you is exchanging an interplay of ideas, debating things, trying to figure out mm-hmm. what's valuable, making things, places like Google, you know, and Facebook are great places to do this because there are other people there who are very, very smart,
mm-hmm.
who are very, very competent at what they do, who want to engage in those debates and in that community of doing stuff.
Right. That's really interesting. And when we when I heard you speak in Tel Aviv, you were talking about how one of the results of the need to be respected and having the freedom of autonomy is you found a niche in facilitating other designers to be creative,
mm-hmm.
and that expressed itself at Tiana Lacks as you're running mm-hmm. the company, mentoring other designers. How does that show itself in Facebook?
I mean, that is my job is essentially like, I don't make anything, right? Like you will not find me in
pixels.
Sketch or mm-hmm. pixels or anything like that. Right. So my entire job is to help others be good at what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think where I'm good, you'd have to ask them more than ask me, but what I like to think I'm good at is, or where I feel I'm at my best is when I'm able to engage in a dialogue with them about the work they're doing, help them contextualize it with maybe other things, other ideas. A lot of times I find designers, it's very easy, and especially now in some of these companies at scale, which is like, you can just get buried in your task list.
Yeah.
And you're like doing the next task to like,
yeah.
you know, to mark it off. And you might be having really good craft, right? Where things are lined up and they're part of the system and they're spot on. But what I'm finding increasingly is that what's missing is do the designers see the whole playing field? Do they understand how this thing that they're working on connects to something else, and how is that working towards some greater whole? And that's something I can help provide, right? So a lot of times in my one-to-ones, while we're talking about their career and we're talking about all those things that they want, a lot of that one-to-one is just spent talking out like what they're working on and how that relates to other things, and making sure that they have all the right inputs to generate the right output. And now look, that's my style. Right. I think other design managers, and I think there's an interesting discussion that I believe we're going to have about what design leadership looks like now. And how that's probably changed. I think that there's different ways of design leadership. My style, like, there's many ways to greatness, right? And and so I do not say this discounting other manager styles or things like that, but what works for me and where I feel like the people who thrive working with me, we're having a set of product conversations, and then we're having a set of career conversations. We're not having as many personal conversations. That's something I'm not as good at as I think other managers are. Because I have a very low need to be liked, I have a blind spot around some of the softer stuff. Whereas I think other managers are much better at, like, how's your family? Like, how's your, you know, and I'm just less good at that.
That's interesting. What do you want to get better at as a manager at Facebook?
I probably need to get a little bit better at some of that warmth stuff.
some of that warmth.
Some of that, you know, bedside management.
I think I just said enough. I've said enough. Yeah. One of the challenges that I think I have when talking about people's careers is my career is very unplanned, and so the notion of having an intentionally planned career is something I have to work on working with people, because I don't have that experience of having intentionally managed my career. My career just kind of organically grew, and I logically understand that that is not acceptable answer when having a career conversation with someone inside of a more structured company, where a path needs to be more carved and intentional.
Right.
So I need to get better at that. I think I'm good with it with younger designers, because I think I have enough knowledge there about, like, the skills they're going to need to develop. As we get up and get senior people, like, there are people who, you know, work with me right now who are trying to achieve my level. And they're like, what do I need to get your level? And that's a really hard question to answer.
Yeah, I don't even know what I did.
Yeah, well, you start a company, you work at it for 12 years. like, it's just, that's not a good answer.
No. So
I have to wait 12
yeah,
years?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you got to go start a company. And build it up.
Go start a company. Before we close, I want to ask you, what do you counsel those younger designers to do?
So the thing that I'm pretty big on is, I think that a designer's career is all about ability to deal with ambiguity. So when you're really junior, you have a very low ability to deal with ambiguity, and nor do we ask you to do it. You tend to be, you know, prescribed things to do, like do this, do that, do that. And then to get to the next level, you got to be able to handle some amount of ambiguity, right? And then as you get up, and as you rise up, your ability to identify ambiguous situations and go in and create clarity around them in whatever way you do that. Right. So sometimes some people do that entirely through execution. Some people do that through influence. Some people do that through just debate, discussion. Some people do that through, like, writing docs. You know, like, I see some designers who do it by writing long notes of, like, their thinking, and maybe interspersing some sketches or, you know, wireframes or even designs to try to help people bring clarity to that ambiguity. But to me, it's all about moving up that line.
I really like that you're respecting different people's process. In that, you know, I'm in that stage where I'm learning that dealing with ambiguity is actually a big thing that we talk about a lot at Google. And for someone like me who's transitioning into, like, a more, you know, strategy slash kind of, like, leadership
product that, thinking,
that's what I'm being like shaped for there, and I'm, like, learning about, like, you know, socializing the work and, like dealing with ambiguity, and so one of the questions I have is, like, I need to learn how to deal with ambiguity, but, like, how do I do that? And in those few sentences you're saying now really actually cast a big light on it. And like, I love that it respects different people's, you know, tendencies for process. That's really great.
I think the organization though has a big influence in that, because for example, let's say you're a designer who wants to influence through execution, mm-hmm. meaning what you really want to do is just actually do the heads down work to design the solution or prototype it or whatever method you use. But really you want to present some artifact mm-hmm. of design and be like, we should build this. Your organization has to be able to like utilize that. So, mm-hmm. you know, there are companies out there where they just wouldn't know what to do with that mm-hmm. thing. And so it's hard to operate if that's the way you want to do it, where what they like, no, the way we do this is you write up a one page mm-hmm. memo and mm-hmm. that memo kind of finds its way mm-hmm. to a VP, and the VP needs to sign off on the memo, and then it comes back and then we start building it. So I think the organization is important to this, but I encourage, in an ideal organization, any one of those methods should be effective.
Mm-hmm, right.
But in reality, some work better in different companies.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks for pulling that out. And we're going to end the episode right there. And when we come back next week, we're going to talk with John about sort of the community backlash that occurred and when John closed down the shop. And we want to talk also about dealing with change and what we can expect, or what we hope to expect, what we think we're going to expect in the future of design and craftsmanship. Before we end, Lost, we have a review.
I do have
John. We like to read reviews every episode.
Are these like just from the iTunes store?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, people go through the hell to write the reviews. Like, it's actually really hard to write.
Have
a
you ever
review
seen on the experience of writing a review on iTunes?
It's not great.
It is horrible.
The UX is pretty hard to go. So people put a lot of energy in just to say hello, and so we all
get. So you feel you need to pay it back.
Yeah, just pay it back.
So this one is from Reader 911, left on the 26th of August, and it's titled "Inspirational, Creative, and Constructive." Here's the review. Lighthearted podcast with two awesome guys who are here to educate and broaden your mind. They're funny, motivating, and they always have positive messages to deliver. Their main genre is design, but their lessons can be applied to all aspects of life. Whether or not you are creative, keep up the amazing work, guys. This is from Reader 911.
That's so nice. Thank you, Reader 911.
Hear that?
Well, like, you know what? I really like when people say that the podcast is about design, but it's applicable in so many ways. And I think that, like, that doesn't necessarily speak to the content of the podcast, but it speaks to like what design is.
Yes.
And when people can like pull that out of what these discussions are, I don't know, for me, that just really makes it.
It makes it for me. It's like when I'm talking to my parents and my sisters and they're talking about some problems or whatever they're doing, I'm like, well, design thinking, and I just start going into it. But it's like, that's how I see the world.
Right.
And it's applicable to many aspects of how I interact with the world,
uh-huh.
right? And so it's great when we get reviews like that.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Reader 911. And that's the end of the episode. Next week, you're going to tune in for episode number 2 with John. And we were just talking to John. He wants to discuss the state of the industry and talk about some futurism as well. Where are we going? And that's going to be some really, really exciting things. So we'll see you guys next week. That was a podcast.
The other was horseshit.